Hello everyone. Welcome to episode number 8 of our series in which we are studying End Times Bible Prophecy, based upon the series we have titled the Bible Prophecy Masterclass. In this, which might be considered part 3 of the discussion begun in episode number 5, we will cover Ezekiel 38 verses 10 to 23. In so doing, we will attempt to flesh out the desires that God defines as hooks through the nose that will be used to bait and thereby draw Gog and his coalition of nations into the trap he has set for them in Eretz Israel. The question before us is why? Looking past the hand of God, what specifically would provoke not just a nation so large as Russia but a huge conglomerate of nations to waste time and energy in pursuit of a landmass so tiny as the land of Israel? What nerve or nerves is God planning to play upon here that will draw the nations to their inevitable doom? As usual, the text for this study series is Judgment Day, Volume 2, Prelude to Armageddon, Part 2, Israel Catapulted to Global Superpower, Subtitle, A Muslim's Nightmare, the writer of said series being Mr. Alvin Mitchell, and I, Liam, will once again be your affable host. Pray with us once more, won't you, for the blessing of God upon this and all of the studies to come in this highly informative and instructive series. Ezekiel 38 verses 10 to 23. Gog's plan, Shoah. God's nose rings. Verse 10, this is what the Lord like no other, the self-existent one, who exists forever, Adonai Jehovah, has to say, at the time of your attack, you will proceed according to a preconceived, mischievous plan, diabolical in nature. You will talk to yourself about how you will militarily harass a land defenseless, living safely and at peace, unable to match and fend against your own military might, for the purpose of pillaging, openly robbing, and plundering. Verse 14, for this reason, son of man, you are my mouthpiece, speak and tell Gog, this is what the Lord of all lords, who is self-existing eternally, has to say, in the day when my people are living securely, will you not be fully aware, knowing well their vulnerability? Still tough to envision, is it not? And yet, why should it be, knowing the diplomatic and trade ties between the two countries? How a nation like Russia could ever be so foolish as to consider war with a nation like Israel, for the purpose of taking, what? Both nations are cash-strapped and economically challenged, so what does a tiny, virtually insignificant little country like Israel possibly have that would ever satisfy the virtually unquenchable thirst of one as large as Russia's? One would think that just the sheer cost of an assault on a scale akin to the one portrayed here might far outweigh negatively anything or any benefit that might be gained from such a venture, particularly given the financial straits the Jews face right now. At 6,562,000 square miles, what could a nation the size of Russia, with its vast resources, ever see in a nation like Israel, measuring only around 7,849,000 square miles? Indications are such that, or, they suggest that, Russia has far greater resources at its disposal than Israel has space to live. First off, we know that whereas the Russian will not recognize the hand of the living God in his activity, there will be no advance warnings, other than this prophetic reminder, no evidence for him or the watching world to suggest that God is pulling strings and shifting levers behind the scenes to maneuver him into place. Life will proceed as normal. All that he will attempt will be first and foremost per the instigation of the Almighty himself, although he and his allies will think that he does it of his own volition. They will not know that this impossible suicidal venture upon which they have secretly conspired and collaborated to embark is per the plan and will of God, more so than a matter of their own initiative. Still, the questions persist. What will be going on in the psyche of the Slav at this future time, in the end times? What specifically might be the bait or lures on which God will cause Gog to fixate, so that he will want to pillage and plunder, with so overwhelming a force of European, Islamic, and North African allies, the incursion into Afghanistan and into Georgia during the early 80s and 90s, respectively countries much larger than Israel, required only Russia stand alone. Therefore, it is only rational to assume that, per the hand and plan of Almighty God, there will be something else troubling about Israel triggering this deadly response, involving so many people in so confined a space. What will it be? Certainly not oil. At number 7 in the world of oil production, it is rumored that a simple shift in accounting methods and procedures by all of the Soviet's major oil producers could conceivably shoot them into the number 2 spot, right behind Saudi Arabia. Since the initial writing of this piece, that shift has apparently been made, as Russia now sits, it is said, at number 3, behind the Saudis. The secret storehouse, the one studied earlier containing the buried, concealed treasures. Could be, but, to date true to its nature no one knows what, or, where that is, much less the Russians. Nevertheless, in light of what will be the inevitable outcome of this war, and in light of the Slav's inability to make full use of his own resources, it is quite likely that he and Israel's Islamic/Arab neighbors are the keeper of the secret storehouse, which God intends to open and with which he intends to pacify their needs, in addition to the discoveries the Jews have made in recent years within its own borders. To motivate the Russian to attack Israel, there are several strong possibilities God might use as rings in his nose, not the least of which is its shaky alliance with the world of Islam. The nose ring of deprivation. God gave him talent, a talent equal, no less, to that of those whom he considers his worst nemesis. God set him on top of a land filled with resources, like the talented Oriental, who is a small people having few resources. God has given him the examples of his neighbors in the West, who he can plainly see and observe, but who he cannot emulate, for, beyond things military, God has dealt to him as well the hand of deprivation, withholding from him the road to fullness and prosperity, in the midst of plenty that, to the point of excess, the road is blocked to him, he cannot pass over, bypass it or travel on it, though it remains ever within plain sight. Left to his own devices, whether defined as wants or needs, his hunger can never be satisfied. To the degree that Gog, in the land of Magog, is a reference to the top leadership of modern-day Russia, this prophecy portends several things. 1. What we have here is a people utterly despised by Adonai Jehovah, with a hatred matched only by his hatred for Babylon the Great, as we shall see, when we consider Revelation 17 and 18. 2. Russia today, in spite of its own vast resources, underdeveloped and untapped, is still poised to operate only on a take or, what's yours is mine, and I want it now, mentality. Sidebar. Interesting side note, a young man was featured this morning, Sunday, May 1, 05, on Robert Schuller's Hour of Power broadcast. I believe his name was given as Andrei Danilenko, a first-generation, American-born Russian. This man stated that he was part of a non-profit farming organization, sponsored in some way and or sent out by Schuller's church, based in Russia, for the sole purpose of assisting the Russians as they learned to develop more effective and efficient farming methods, so that they could produce enough food to survive, which seems to suggest that Russian soil is, as is, fully capable of meeting the food needs of that nation's people. If one recalls correctly, it was either the Ukraine or Romania. That was the nation's breadbasket during the Soviet years. It seems, moreover, that as of 1991, the Soviets were headed for a real food crisis, simply because they have not yet learned to manage the business of farming so as to efficiently grow the food they need to feed themselves, without heavy reliance on imports. As of 1993, according to Schuller, 50% of Russian farmable land was untilled. If one recalls correctly, one of the problems they faced was brought on by improper application of fertilizers on tilled lands. They apparently do not have enough trained farmers either. Thus, it might be argued that we have before us a near-perfect illustration of the proverbial adages, lack of vision is a destroyer of any people and there is counsel and wisdom in the voices of many advisors, Proverbs 29 verse 18, 11 verse 14, 15 22. They are the product of a series, over centuries, of godless, self-serving governments that never encourage vision beyond what is good for the ruling elite. Worse than having no vision in general, they have never had a clear vision of the living God. All the counsel on which the people of the Rus hang and eke out their day-to-day existences revolves or has revolved around either one individual or one group of individuals. Where the persons governed under these types of regimes have not been acclimated to thinking outside the box they have created, the want for vision can cause or occasion the death of virtually any culture. In lieu of collapse, however, Russia's culture is being preserved intentionally by the hand of God, for the wrath of God. 3. Not only have the Russians not been able to rise to the level of their potential, across the board, on the world stage heretofore, they are not likely to any time soon. Fertilizer, that's the operative term. If Russia is ever able to make full use of all its land in the production of its own food supply, it will need a good supply of fertilizers to bring that land to maximum fruition, as well as adequate training in its proper implementation. Herein, then, may well be one of the rings or lures that God will use to draw them into his trap. If they can get control of Israel, which would also give them easy access to the Dead Sea, and its rich, valuable supply of mineral, or natural, salts among which is enough potash to service the world's fertilizer need for 250 years, Russia's own needs would be settled for life. Moreover, mining the Dead Sea might be easier and more profitable than drilling for oil in the Siberian permafrost. By holding them back, keeping them economically depressed, by not allowing them to excel, he has intentionally created within them a driving, throbbing hunger, so that, like a panic-stricken monster held within the clutches of sheer desperation, they will come according to his scheduling, riding the horn of dilemma on a dual-crested wave of absolute delirium and determination, surfing into certain and unavoidable disaster. Sidebar. Indeed, Russia's problem since the Soviet breakup in 1991 has been described as vast and impervious to outside intervention. It is a country that cannot be delivered from its problems, even with foreign aid, though they have made up for it in a manner that might be described militarily as nothing short of magnificently. They did lose the arms race and their status as a global superpower, due more to costs and financing than to technology. The rubble collapsed in 1999, the government cannot collect enough taxes to stay afloat. Life expectancy among Slavic men has dropped from 65 to 58. Life is that tough in what should and could easily be a thriving economy. The nation's population woes, which never recovered from the millions slaughtered under Lenin and Stalin during his administration and in World War II, have welcomed yet another in the form of a 400,000 head drop. In 1998, making matters worse, President Putin has recently admitted that 15% of Russian women are infertile, while 75% cannot deliver a normal, healthy birth without complications. It cannot even foot the bill to safeguard nuclear facilities simply abandoned in countries it no longer controls. After the Cold War days, the U.S. is said to have had to step in to do that, or to provide compensation or employment so as to keep nuke technology and out-of-work nuke scientists from winding up in bad company. Given this kind of a legacy, it should not, then, be hard to see what a breeze it will be slash has been for God to whet the Russia's appetite against his people, this remnant of a folk who saw themselves as more apt to be the employer of any god, or god, than to submit to any as servant. Their own insatiable need is killing them, but for the Robert Schuller initiative, that nation might literally be on the brink of starvation by now. In this, one can be sure, it will not be for no good reason. The Almighty will simply roll out of bed one heavenly morning and arbitrarily call for a danger of this magnitude against his people. The basis for his plan here will be the exploitability of the situations that be, so to speak. Russia has needs, dire needs as shown above. Russia has the means to a solid satisfaction of its own needs. Russia cannot connect the dots or join the tails between its needs and its means and resources so as to foment a resolution to its needs. Furthermore, to the Arab world, Israel's location on the Mediterranean has long been known for its favorable situation as an ideal shipping port for oil destined to points west on the Mediterranean and beyond. Sidebar. In addition, as of today, August 14, 2005, Recent news reports relate the following, as regards Russian and Mideastern oil reserves and the Israeli-Gaza pullout, all the easy oil, that is, that which is easily accessible, is almost depleted. Russia and other oil-producing nations are running, not out of oil but out of creative ways to economically tap into the remaining reserves, regardless of how much there is. Both Russia and Israel are said to be cash-strapped. It is known that Israel gets most of its crude from the Soviets. It is not known how much, if any, is obtained on credit. Assuming that at least some is, this could conceivably create a breakdown in diplomacy, should Israel default, thereby inducing or boosting the Russian incentive to invade Palestine, similar to the current Russo-slash-Persian crisis over Iran's missed payments to the Rus for nuclear reactor-slash-power plant-related services and equipment, as of April 15, 2007, according to a Yahoo News article. Moreover, as Israel removes its settlers from the Gaza Strip, and as Palestinians celebrate and revel in their victory, they also make it plain that they are not the least bit satisfied. They want all of Palestine, period, particularly the West Bank, home to 240,000 settlers. Thus, between the Rus and the Arab, for better or for worse, good or bad, whether right or wrong, its wealth of resources which it cannot procure or manage prosperously is solid basis as to why a raid on the Jewish state would be in each of their own best interests, and it is, or it appears to be upon these facts that the Lord God will play, as he drives the Slav, at the forefront of the impending invasion, to resort to old tricks, to scratch his itch, in satisfaction of his want, at someone else's expense. Moreover, for reasons to be brought out later, Russia will be the only place on planet Earth during those days with so much to offer, in one place. Whoever controls it will be the most powerful people on Earth. Thus, if the truth be known, then, it might be argued that ultimately the purpose of the incursion into Israel by the Rus and company is not so much to get something from Israel as it is to ensure that, what might be termed, the other half of the Jew equation, never unites with its own internal Jews, so as to take that from which he, Russia, can neither benefit to the fullest, nor keep, indefinitely. The nose ring of anxiety. Without doubt, Russia's prevailing deprivation and its evident valuable resources, potentially vulnerable, coalesce so as to leave it in a position most precarious. The nation's predicament, as they survey and monitor continuously their situation, must to them be reminiscent of the latter days of their last czarist regime, which yielded in a bloodbath and a bloody path leading to the world's first fully functioning, bloodthirsty Marxist-Bolshevist regime, which in turn wielded imperialist, global ambitions from its foundation. They cannot but be keenly aware that as they watch and observe things from their perspective, other eyes, with gleaming beams, are ever watching, monitoring every aspect of her health and climate, from within and from without, as they await greedily her moment of optimum weakness, sure to come, if she does not act, reposition herself first. It might rightly be argued that her chief concern for the moment would, or, perhaps should, be the Eastern European Jews, the Ashkenazim. From a 1,000-year slumber of virtual insignificance and apparent, relative indifference, they arose to compete successfully with the Germans for a control of Poland that left even native Poles at the socio-slash-economic bottom, only to lose when the deadly Nazi invaders snuffed out the wind of 3.5 million of their ranks. They seized control of Russia in a radical takeover, running the government for 7 years, losing all gains upon Lenin's death and Stalin's rise, as he quite literally killed Jew involvement in the Marxist-slash-Leninist dream, along with them. With a huge presence and footprint in the U.S., by virtue of control of major media markets and heavy indulgence in U.S. politics, they now control Jerusalem, but, what some analysts say they want, understandably, is Moscow. Just as Zion represents the ancestral homeland of the Semite, so Moscow represents the ancestral homeland of the Ashkenazim. It is here from whence they come, not Israel, for they are primarily descendants of the ancient Khazari, not the Semitic Jews. Stalin purged the Communist Party and destroyed the Jewish elements of the Bolshevik consortium when he took office, following the death of Lenin, in 1924, by killing every one of the original Bolsheviks, including Trotsky, whom he tracked down for the purpose, in Mexico. The Communist Party itself died, effectively, with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. The closest reminder remaining of the old Bolshevik regime and school of thought is President Vladimir Putin, former head of the KGB, Chaika, which was the Bolsheviks' dreaded secret police. Thus, on the other hand, communism is very much alive in Russia. Indicative of his authority, recent indications are such that there is a bit of unrest in today's Russian Federation due to Putin's tightening of the reins and rollback, or threat to rollback, of the freedoms Russians have gained since the USSR collapse. Thus, whatever there is that is left of the Bolshevik/communist system is still planted firmly within the grasp of the Slav, should something ever signal that the timing is right for a return, whole hog, to that form of government. Interestingly, as of today, July 22, 2008, Putin is no longer president, but, in accord with plans hammered out and set in place long before his legally mandated set down, he now holds the office of prime minister, where he is said to wield a power and influence that is unprecedented for that office in Russia. Effectively, he still runs Russia, not the new president. Note, as of this day, 04/28/2013, Mr. Putin has been back at the helm, on the throne, as Russian president for almost a year, or, since May 7, 2012. Which means, or certainly, suggests strongly, then, that from within, whatever Russia's current woes, reminiscent of the early 1900s, there is likely to be little cause for concern over the possibility of a Jew-led uprising and takeover, after the order of the Bolshevik-styled revolution staged in 1917, or, is there? Current indications are such that Russia cannot positively, accurately account for all of its Jews. It does not know with any measurable certainty how many there are, thus, it cannot know with any certainty where they are within the system, or what they might be up to. What is known is that a very large and significant percentage of the oligarchs, the wealthy elites who actually run and control Russia's industry and politics, and, thus, Putin, from behind the scenes are in fact, Jews. There is, thus, nonetheless, plenty of cause for concern, and perhaps anxiety, on the part of every Slav. Stalin checked and quelled one threat with the murders of all the old guard Jew founders of the Bolsheviks, the murders of millions of his own countrymen among whom were no doubt millions of Jews, Semite, and self-styled. Even with the 6 million Jews that Hitler is alleged to have murdered, there are still millions left worldwide. An estimated 5 million of those are said to be Ashkenazim, Yiddish-speaking, self-styled remnants of the Khazars. They are the same folks who gave us the horror of the original Bolsheviks, while at the same time manning the desert fields of Israel with what began, under a guise of innocence, in the shadows of the apparent passivity of Zionism, who receive help and support from the hands of some of the roughly 5 million American Jews, 93% or 4.65 million of whom are family and relative to those same Ashkenazim, from Eastern Europe. Each faction was, is, anti-God, anti-Semite Jew, in that he the Semite is regarded as reactionary, and thus, despised for his unwillingness to shed his antiquated notions, way of life and professed reliance upon God, on which account he will not initiate the fight to retake Israel. He yearns as well for an occasion for the imposition of its will upon others, locally in Israel, or globally, by force. They cannot do a thing, however, except bide their time in their current preoccupation, from the shores of Israel, at Russia's front door as they await an opportune time, a further weakening, a furtherance of economic, social, and political degeneration, so as to pick up where they left off in Bolshevism. Moreover, they need the crude upon which Russia sits. No nation today can long survive in a wartime situation without petroleum. The Germans realized this, as they systematically contained and eliminated all potential opposition on the road to occupation of Magog's vital oil reserves. Nobody knows better than the Russian that they are there. None knows better than they the dire consequences, should Russia, as it inevitably very well could, take one more crucial nosedive, akin to the 1991 Soviet fall. Herein, then, lies the most plausible of all the possible hooks by means of which God will drag the Slav over the Caucasus into the angry, vicious jaws of an unquenchable death, lurking and waiting hungrily for his arrival upon the mountains of Israel. Gog, the mountain, who is the Rosh or chief of the princes of Magog, the land of the mountain, knows that beyond a certain point, a preemptive first strike is his only option to protection of his assets. Moreover, as everyone will remember the grand initiatives of the Bolshevik faction of the self-styled Jews almost 100 years ago, no one will want to see the potential of Russia, their industrial might, their nuke stockpiles numbering in the thousands, 1,700 to 2,000 warheads, bountiful resources, and of course their vast energy reserves of coal and crude, in their hands. Coupled with their current occupation of that strategic, prime location in the Levant, Palestine, this could easily spell global disaster. Moreover, given his recent saber-rattling and exhibition of an unwavering determination to ensure that Iran never enriches weapons-grade uranium, none is likely to doubt as but that the deal is cinched, should this false, self-styled Jew ever get his hands on Russia, as he will, and all of its resources. At only 4.2% of the Russian population when Eastern European Ashkenazi pulled off the October Revolution in 1917, he has already secured for himself a permanent place in the consciences of the discerning, and on all the military maps of that region, if not the world. He has demonstrated quite thoroughly, first by the Bolshevik Rebellion, a different group operating on different ideology and philosophical assumptions, but of the same people, and repeatedly by his many victories over insurmountable odds and challenges mounted by the inhospitable, angry Muslims, the other half of the modern Khazar equation, as it were, and conclusively that he is quite capable of achieving major victories, with a small force. Gog will, or, should have little difficulty convincing the rest of Europe, none rallying the Arabs, of the benefits of coming to his aid, of joining forces with him. For this reason, then, the sons of the Khazari will not have to do a thing, this time, as the battle will be brought straight to them, specialty, as it were, and dropped upon their doorstep. The anxious and nervous Russians will not wait. Together with the eager, trigger-happy Muslim world, and Western Europe, Gomer, as well as Northern Africa, they will take full advantage of the sudden absence of the one force that could have stopped them. See study on Babylon the Great, America in Bible prophecy, attacking ravenously, literally from every direction. Their combined numbers will relieve the pressure such an initiative would demand and place on Magog standalone, while his technological savvy and sophistication, upon which strengths he has produced a heavily military-oriented industry, will give them, the Arab world, Gomer, i.e., those of Western Europe already have it, an edge they, the Muslims, cannot produce for themselves independently. Ahmadinejad's push to produce warplanes, nukes, and missiles, notwithstanding. Sidebar. Zion, stepping stone to Moscow. The Russian Slav knows his surroundings. He is keenly aware of his history. He remembers well the Khazar, with whom he shared, but who then, in those days, owned the lion's portion of the land he now controls, even as he has not forgotten the Jews of Khazaria, the heavy taxation, the cruelty, his might and his determination. He can recall driving the people out, with a little help from the Byzantines, and destroying a kingdom, but not its lifeblood. Moreover, being astute in matters historical, particularly as they pertain to his own past, he cannot but be fully apprised that, given the Khazar was only defeated, never destroyed as an entity, that fact alone may just be cause for major concern, if not alarm. For, when he left his homeland, the Khazar did so not as the Khazar he was, as rather, wherever he has settled, wherever he has roamed for the past approximately 1,000 years since the collapse of the kingdom of Khazaria, he has done so always under the ruse and guise of the despised Jew. So thorough has been his association with Jewish culture, per his interpretation, none who knew anything at all has ever been inclined to think of the Khazar and his Khazaria on a par greater than myth. This too, the Slav knows, and he knows it well. More recently, he remembers the Communist Party, said to have been top-heavy with Jews of Khazaria. Lenin was of mixed bloods, some of it Jew, and Leon Trotsky, his sidekick and friend, was all Jew. Almost all were East European, Ashkenazim, or Khazar. Realizing then that this gathering of the Jews in Israel could eventually represent the sum of all the Jews worldwide, that Russian, yesterday's Slav, and tributary to the Khazar, cannot but know that this will of necessity include all of the Ashkenazim, among whom will reside the Khazar to the tune of around 92%, by some estimates a sizable force of roughly 5 to 6 million Jews. That could mean approximately 13 million strong total, and could justly be a cause for major concern within the ranks of the Rus, not so much as it pertains to any Jew who is a Jew, as to that Jew who is in fact Khazar. Why is this so significant? Jews within, though small in number, vying for a return to power, and Jews without, on Russian doorsteps, but not under Russian control, able to exert a presence, an authority, and an influence that the Rus could find threatening directly, or indirectly via the Russian Federation's Arab allies and cronies. Actually, some estimates put the number of Jews within Russia as potentially between 230,000 and 10 million, the implication here being, of course, that Russia has done a poor job of keeping track of perhaps the most dangerous element of its population. The nose ring, would you think? It is a thought most compelling, is it not? Imagine God, and remember, he did not say how the nose ring thing would be set up and implemented, he only assures us that it will be done, in which case, planting the Russ's old cunning, calculating, scheming enemy on his doorstep, after centuries in absentia, making him nervous and thereby, if only in part, provoking him to act, might be just as effective as anything else. Having all the Jews and the Khazars trapped within an area only 200 miles long by less than 75 miles wide might be the best time ever to be rid of two birds, as it were, with the stone of one fatal attack. The sight will exude such appeal, the Russians, per the will and mind of God, will jump at the chance to lead the assault in the final extermination of two mortal enemies, one theirs, the Khazarian Jew, the other that of their neighbors and allies in the world of the Arabs, the Semitic Jew. Without a doubt, though the Ashkenazim/Khazar went with all other Semite Jews, leading them to their home in Palestine, as it was they who spearheaded the various Zionist movements, some of which failed, he went with his sights on Israel, but with his home in Russia in his heart. The reason? Quite simply, there is nothing in Israel beyond the Dead Sea. Whether he knew this or not in 1948, he knows this very well now. No informed Jew, real, Khazar, or otherwise, can ever realistically expect to be squeezed out of all the world at large into that tiny strip of land, and there, live happily ever after. The hostility of a world of Arabs utterly precludes that possibility. He will need to establish, set up and maintain a perpetual defensive posture dependent upon raw materials and energy and lots of both, neither of which is currently present or readily accessible in Eretz Israel in any significant amounts. Russia, however, has both common knowledge to the Jew within, and to the Jew without, working in tandem, assuming and believing both Jews to be those of Khazaria. Exploitation of her many manifest weaknesses could prove to be an appetizer all too tempting to pass up. There can be little question as but that the Slav is, or will be, well aware of this threat. Like most nations, he gave no thought to the prospect of a resurrected Israel, much less to any chance for her survival if she did live again, however the annoying, lingering, prevailing presence being such as it is, and with mounting global anti-Semitism threatening to dump 13 million Jews, with the Khazar, in that region eminently, the Slav has at least some cause for sleepless nights. For this reason, when the time comes as God Almighty gives the nod, Russia will have to act quickly and decisively. A full-scale, coordinated, military incursion is of the essence. He cannot afford the luxury of even a minor miscalculation. Given that occupation is the objective once the smoke clears, use of nuclear WMD weapons, which would be simple and direct, are out of the question due to the threat of nuclear fallout and radioactive contamination, as this would leave the area uninhabitable. Russia's military is said to be primarily strategic by virtue of its ICBMs, meaning it does not have to rely on or field a tactical force to win any military offensive. On the other hand, Israel's 200 warheads, a number that could conceivably have mushroomed by the time of the incursion, could complicate matters should she ever become the least bit suspicious. Moreover, Israel makes no secret of her intent to attack, should it ever have clear cause to believe that Iran has entered the global arena of those having nuke warheads. The fact that Israel is living at peace, apparently not contemplating war, suggests that, whatever Iran's plans, at the moment and in the future, to enrich uranium, it may not have a warhead when the fighting starts. Nonetheless, should the Jew ever get any sense, any advance warning of the scope and magnitude of the impending danger in his future, the nation might realistically be inclined to even the odds by means of whatever the number of warheads at its disposal. Thus, the need for an overwhelming, preemptive, first strike, on the scale of Ezekiel's vision, Israel must be destroyed totally, after having been robbed of any and every opportunity to retaliate, and deprived of any chance for a nuke response, kind of goes without saying. The Ashkenazim is not likely to think much of the warnings laid out in a paper such as this, should he ever be made aware, given that he does not believe in God. All right, my friends, here looks like a good place to end today's podcast of the Bible Prophecy Masterclass. We do sincerely hope to see you next time for episode number 9, when we will continue our discussion of what by all outward appearances looks like God's intentional, reckless endangerment of his beleaguered people. Tell others about the podcast, won't you, and smash that like button as you depart. Until our next meeting, may God bless you all.